Let's see. We're going to talk about a couple of very different subjects today. First of all, we're going to have Joe Cirincione of the Center for American Progress in to talk about the recent intelligence report that Iran has no nuclear weapons program. Now hear this. And then later in the program, I'll be joined by Chef Ann Cooper, who's director of nutrition services in the city of Berkeley's Unified School District. She's the author of Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children. And we'll talk about the crisis in kids' food and the farm bill that could make things better or not. And that farm bill is now sort of fast-tracked where they might end up passing something by Christmas. So we're going to be looking at things that you, as listeners, could do to weigh in on that before it's too late. When no WMD could be found in Iraq, several members of the Bush administration justified the imminent preemptive invasion because, quote, we could not afford for the smoking gun to come in the form of a mushroom cloud, unquote. As we all know, it turned out Saddam had no bomb and probably no bomb program. Now, for months, we've heard consistent fear-mongering from a Bush administration that appears eager to attack Iran. Bush himself recently linked Iran to World War III. Now comes word from the National Intelligence Estimate that Iran halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003. At the same time, the administration handles Pervez Musharraf with kid gloves as he asserts dictatorial powers to control a very volatile and nuclear-armed Pakistan, home of Dr. Khan's global atomic sales bazaar. 2005 Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei, director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, has high praise for the book Bomb Scare by today's guest, Joe Cirincione. Quote, at a time of challenges and uncertainties regarding the nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament regime, the book offers a comprehensive review of the history and theory of nuclear weapons, as well as of the policy options before us today in our common endeavor to address the most pressing threats, existing arsenals, the emergence of nuclear-armed states, and nuclear terrorism. Joe Cirincione is the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He teaches at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And he previously served as director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for 8 years. He's co-author of Universal Compliance, A Strategy for Nuclear Security, and the author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. His newest, as I mentioned before, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. Welcome, Joseph Cirincione.
Hi, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Okay, and this time we have you on because it seems there's some good news. What is the story regarding the National Intelligence Estimate report? And, you know, there's a lot of questions there, but where does it, what's your take on the timing, the meaning, the impact, etc.?
Well, let's first start with what the NIE says. It says that Iran most likely had a nuclear weapons program, but it suspended that program in 2003, and it believes that Iran has not restarted that program. It also finds, and this I think is a more significant finding actually, that the suspension of the program shows that Iran can be influenced by international pressures and scrutiny, and that therefore, some combination of pressures and incentives could bring about a change in Iranian behavior in the future, a permanent end to the program, perhaps a reconciliation between the United States and Iran. The impact has been enormous. I have never seen an NIE have this kind of sudden, dramatic change in a debate. The only thing that comes close is really the Iraq NIE, but even that took months to develop. That is the now we know discredited intelligence estimate before the Iraq war that found that Saddam Hussein had programs. This NIE, you know, caused a political earthquake in Washington. It has three effects immediately. One, it takes off the table the military option for attacking Iran, something that you and others have been talking about, everyone's been talking about it for months now, even years, the idea that the vice president and the president wanted to attack Iran. That military option is now off the table. I think it's out of the room. We're not going to see that for the rest of the administration.
And many of us were afraid that that would be the, you know, the sort of the ultimate campaign weapon. So this is good news.
Absolutely. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, there were columns being written about this and suspicions that the president would use this for political means in the campaign, or that, you know, he was committed to overthrowing the regime in Iran and he would do this before he left office to get it. That's all.
Right, and also was a key campaign waving thing for folks like Giuliani.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you had the Republican candidates talking about using tactical nuclear weapons on Iran. Incredible rhetoric coming out from the conservatives in this recent period. That's over. I also believe that we're seeing that this effectively is the death certificate for the Bush doctrine. That is, the idea that we could use military force as our primary instrument of statecraft, that the way to solve proliferation was by invading countries and overthrowing their regimes. This whole doctrine of preventive war, that we had to go to war to eliminate even emerging threats, something that might develop down the road, that was the justification for the war in Iraq. I think that whole Bush doctrine is now dead. It's over. It's an ex-doctrine. So it's more than just Iran here. And third, and this is a very positive sign, I think this new estimate shows the restoration of professionalism and integrity to the intelligence agencies, to the entire threat assessment process. After almost 10 years now of having our assessments battered by political forces, that caused the intelligence agencies to exaggerate the threat from ballistic missiles beginning in 1999, that exaggerated the Iraq threat in 2002, that exaggerated the Iran threat just as recently as 2005. We're finally seeing the restoration of professionalism and integrity, and I think that's a result of the people that have been put in charge here. Mike Hayden, in charge of former general in charge of the CIA, Mike McConnell, the director for national intelligence. These people seem to be protecting the analysts from the kind of pressures they suffered in the past. And, of course, it helps that many of the people who applied the pressure are now out of office. John Bolton, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Donald Rumsfeld, people whose names are now closely associated with the disaster in Iraq. They're gone, and the intelligence agencies have started to restore the integrity of the process. So I think this is a very hopeful sign for the future.
Very good. Joseph Rincione, talk to me a little bit about how the last point you mentioned happened. In other words, the Bush administration is still in charge, Cheney's still vice president. How were those folks in intelligence, appointed by Bush in some cases, able or willing, or just had the ethics to reassert the independence of intelligence?
Well, it's interesting. I just left a faculty luncheon at Georgetown. I teach a seminar at the graduate school at Georgetown University, and we were talking. One of the professors had just returned from a sabbatical where she spent 2 years working at the in the intelligence agencies, and she was talking about this year and a half long struggle to do just what your question gets at, to restore the professionalism and integrity of the services, of the threat assessment process. And she pointed out to the NIE as the first external manifestation of this process. I think it happened for two reasons. One is the failure of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a catastrophe. And the architects of that war, the people who have been associated with it, have left office. So the people I just mentioned with the Department of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld is gone, a sort of an ideological hard-line Secretary of Defense, replaced by Bob Gates, a pragmatist, a centrist in the political spectrum.
Let me see if I get this right. So even though Rumsfeld and Gates are not involved in intelligence per se, they're involved in defense, military, and so on, the influence of a Rumsfeld Defense Department, and even there was that independent intelligence arm, right, that was somehow a Cheney-Rumsfeld invention, that now is gone and defense is keeping its hands off?
Right. Under the defense officials, this is Donald Rumsfeld, Stephen Cambone, who was his undersecretary, Paul Wolfowitz, deputy secretary, and Douglas Feith, they set up something called the Office of Special Plans, that developed separate intelligence, independent of the intelligence agencies, coming out of the Department of Defense. This led to the distortion of the intelligence before the Iraq War, and that false intelligence was piped directly into the White House and, of course, into the media. That operation is now gone. Second, you know, because of the harm that has been done to our military institutions, to the military itself, you know, half the Army and Marine Corps equipment has been destroyed in the war in Iraq. We've lost 3,000 of our finest warriors with another estimated 30,000 wounded. You know, the military has been resisting any plans to go to war with Iran. You know, very explicit statements from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Michael Mullen, the commander of Central Command, Admiral Fallon, and now and saying, we don't want to do this. This is not a good idea. This would harm us. And now you have the intelligence agency standing up and saying there isn't any reason to do this.
Right.
And so I think it's a result of the reaction about these institutions of government, military and intelligence services, now standing up and trying to correct the harm that's been done because of the Iraq war. In short, what you're seeing is the foreign policy's pendulum swinging back towards moderation, swinging back towards pragmatism from the excesses of the Bush years. So we're seeing, in real time, we're seeing the disintegration of the Bush doctrine and a restoration of moderation in national security affairs.
Okay, let me ask one last question on that, because I think this the shifting, as you're talking about, the ripple effects of this or the impacts that this reveals underneath. You hear the neocons, some of them, saying this news is too good to be true. This is, they're now saying somebody else has cherry-picked, that the other side has gone out of its way to politically distort intelligence to come up with this assessment.
You know, you have to admire the audacity of the neoconservatives. I mean, after a run in power where they, and I'm talking about John Bolton, who's been the loudest on this, they bullied the intelligence services to produce intelligence on Iraq that we now know wasn't true, where they bullied the intelligence services to exaggerate the threat from ballistic missiles, to exaggerate the threat from Iran. Now that you're getting a more straightforward, a more honest assessment, they accuse those officials of being political. This is a tried and true technique for them. They've been doing this for decades. It happened during the Cold War, where under Director of Central Intelligence George H.W. Bush, during the Ford administration, he was pressured to appoint a Team B. Some of your listeners may remember this. A Team B headed up by Richard Pipes that formed an independent assessment of the Soviet threat, and not surprisingly, it was hand-picked, stocked with neoconservatives, that found that the Soviet threat was much greater than it was as estimated by the official intelligence agencies, and that underlay a lot of the Reagan buildup when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. And whenever that those kinds of assessments are threatened, they do two things. One, they attack the analysts. They go right after them personally, blame them for being political, either in specifically or just in general, a liberal orientation. Two, they develop an alternative threat assessment. And three, they rush to get that intelligence assessment adopted as official policy. That has worked very well for them in the past, but it won't work here because they're no longer an ascending force. They have lost power. They're a descending force. And that's one of the reasons they're howling so loudly. They're trying to prevent their complete fall from power. I don't think it's going to work. I think we're seeing the end of not just the Bush doctrine, but the entire neoconservative grip on the government and on the Republican Party, which has been their main base. And some even go farther. Some say we may be seeing, and this is what the election next year will be about, the end of the conservative error that started with Ronald Reagan's election to the president in 1980, that we're coming to the close of this now almost 30-year pretty much domination by the conservatives of foreign policy and security policy. And this NIE, this collapse of the Bush doctrine, feeds into that greater turn in our political system.
Right, and I would, you know, with very mixed feelings, say that if the economy continues to weaken and if the subprime crisis or, let's say, the broader credit crisis spreads, that would probably be the nail in the coffin.
That's exactly right. This is more about more than just national security. We have the disaster of the Iraq War, the failure of the Bush security policies to make America more secure. It's actually, we live in a more dangerous world now because of what they've done. But also the economy's in terrible shape. People's, you know, standard of living has gone down. Real wages haven't risen for almost 40 years. The infrastructure, as we saw with the bridge in Minneapolis, is literally collapsing around us.
Yeah.
So all of this feeds into the desire for change in America, the desire for something new. And that something new is a restoration of the kind of professionalism and integrity that used to be the hallmarks of government, but we've lost over the last few decades.
Right, and it's interesting. I hope in January 2009 say that the 21st century has officially begun in the United States.
I do think we're at exactly that kind of moment.
Yeah, it's 8 years late, but it's finally arriving. Before I let you go in 2 or 3 minutes, a couple of other things. We've talked about what this means to the Bush administration. What does this mean to Europe, Russia, China, Iran?
Yeah, well, you know, policy matters, and bad policy has consequences. And as this bad policy collapses, and then we see the corrective of the National Intelligence Estimate, an admission that the previous estimates were wrong, that Iran does not currently have a secret program, we take a hit. We take a loss. This does hurt our bargaining position. It does hurt our leverage. It undermines our credibility, which is already a pretty low rate. So it's going to be tougher for us to get increased sanctions against Iran. And let's get no mistake about this. These are not nice people. They do have a plan to develop the technologies that would put them in a position to build nuclear weapons sometime in the next decade. You know, that is, I believe, part of their intentions. It just isn't as imminent or as driven as the Bush administration has presented it. And as a result, we've lost some of our negotiating ability with Russia and China. The Europeans are still concerned about Iran. They never thought that it was as exaggerated a threat
as the
Bush administration in the first place.
Their concern didn't depend on an imminent threat.
Right. So I still think there's a possibility to get increased sanctions. And I'm in favor of that. You do have to bring pressure on a regime like Iran. The key is not how hot you can make the pressure cooker. It's, is there a release valve? Where's the engagement that's necessary? This is the missing piece in this puzzle. The U.S. now has to agree to have direct talks with Iran. The way we have had direct talks with the Libyans that convinced them to give up their nuclear program, the way we have direct talks with the North Koreans that is resulting in agreements to have them give up their program, that's what's been missing with Iran. And if we do that, you can still rescue this situation. We're going to have to go put up with a few weeks of, you know, Iranian triumphalism and a loss of credibility and prestige. But if we keep in mind the basics, we're still the most powerful country in the world. We have the global networks. We have allies with all of Iran's neighbors. And Iran is a relatively small and isolated country. We can be reminded of the levers we have to play here and the restoration of a sort of negotiating plan for how to deal with this Iraq challenge, not a military plan.
And last question, Joe, do we have the people in place who can actually begin to move that forward prior to the next election?
It's possible, if they're in power to do so. And the person in particular is Nicholas Burns, who's the Deputy Secretary of State under Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He's got the Iran portfolio now. He could do this. Extremely effective, known as a pragmatist. He could do this. John Negroponte, who's also working for Condoleezza Rice as the new Undersecretary of State, he could do this as well. It's possible. You could also bring in an outside, a trusted special envoy to do this, Jim Baker or somebody like Jim Baker.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to do this if the president decides to.
In other words, if he decides that he wants to make a quick about-face and try to make Iran, as well as the efforts he's putting forward on Palestine-Israel, that he's kind of thinking legacy now and wants to save things, that is a possibility. I'm going to let you go.
And then, in fact, this is part of solving Iran, Palestine.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, my guest so far has been Joe Cirincione. As I said, he's a vice president of national security at the Center for American Progress and author of Bomb Scare, a really thorough book on the history and future of nuclear weapons. You can learn more about Joe's work and just about everything. every other issue at AmericanProgress.org. Chef Ann Cooper is a renegade lunch lady who works to transform cafeterias into culinary classrooms for students, one school lunch at a time. She transformed public school cafeterias in New York City, Harlem, Bridgehampton, New York, and now she's in Berkeley, California. She's director of nutrition services for the Berkeley Unified School District, 16 public schools, 9,000 students. She teaches students why good food choices matter, provides fresh, organic lunches to students, and she's at the forefront of a movement to transform the National School Lunch Program into one that places greater emphasis on the health of students than on the financial health of a select few agribusiness giants. Her newest book, Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children, offers strategies for parents and school administrators to begin this change, and you can learn more about that at lunchlessons.org. Ann Cooper, how bad is it, how can it be better, and what can people do about the Farm Bill?
The food in most schools is pretty bad. In Berkeley, and I can, well, you might think of food as really good. When I got here, we had a rotating menu of chicken nuggets, corn dogs, extremo burritos, pizza pockets, and grilled cheese sandwiches, all pre-processed, all full of chemicals, all came in frozen. That was the food we were feeding kids. And that's very typical in schools all across America. Time and time again, we see food that is highly processed, full of additives, high fructose corn syrup, trans fats, things like that. So that's how bad it is. I think from a listener standpoint, one of the things that can happen if you really want to see change is to access school districts, superintendents, and school boards through wellness policies. Every school district in America had to put a wellness policy in place September 06. And so it's really important that we now look at these wellness policies, see what's happened in the first year of implementation, see if they're good enough, and petition our school boards and superintendents to say, you know, if you believe this to be the case, that the food's not good enough and we need to make it better. And that's one of the ways we really can touch school districts. There's certainly other ways you can volunteer, but really to make sustainable change, you have to have the support and leadership from school boards and superintendents. And here in Berkeley, it's because of the strong leadership of the superintendent and school board that this initiative has really been able to become systemic in the district.
And let me ask a quick question. What I said at the top when I introduced you is you not only have made it so that they're eating healthy food, but you're also teaching them the value of nutrition and trying to change not only what they eat at that one meal, but what they understand about food, nutrition, their diet, their health. Where else is this happening in the country? How big is this movement?
Well, I want to explain what that means just really briefly. We have what I consider a three-legged stool: delicious, nutritious food in the cafeterias, hands-on experiential learning and cooking and gardening classes, and academic curriculum tied to 4-5 science. And I think those three things combined are what really helps us change children's relationship to food and make them ask those questions that will lead them to lifelong health. And I don't think that there are certainly places across the country that are doing parts of that. I don't know any other school district that's taken it on as a whole as we are now. But I'm really hopeful that we will see other school districts really trying to make this happen. As far as the Farm Bill, since I know our minutes are getting short.
Right.
I think the Farm Bill is being, you know, back on the voting block today.
Right. What we know is that they reached an agreement to limit the amendments, and so now they think they'll be able to move through pretty quickly. The question is which amendments will be voted in and which will be voted out.
Well, that's right. And one of the amendments that was a priority for some people and a Harkin amendment said that they would limit competitive foods. Now, what people have to understand, and it's really hard in like 1 minute, is that there are foods that are sold in schools. That's the National School Lunch Program. And then there are what's considered competitive foods, and that's not meals, but is often a la carte items called competitive foods. It could be anything from Coca-Cola to Pizza Hut to McDonald's. It also could be all kinds of processed.
And the Harkin Amendment would say they couldn't do that anymore?
No, the Harkin Amendment would limit how bad that junk food, if you will, could be.
Okay, I've got to let you go. If people want to learn more about the Farm Bill, one email address I have is foodbattle.org.
Great.
Okay? The book is Lunch Lessons, Change the Way We Feed Our Children. The site is lunchlessons.org. Get involved in this movement, change the way your school district feeds your kids, and to take action on the Farm Bill, which is up for a vote immediately and will either give us tons more sucrose or maybe a little bit of help in the, our school lunches, foodbattle.org. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic. To you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week and then off for the next two. For audios of this and previous shows, visit tmcnally.podomatic.com. Podomatic.com, also at iTunes. The 1211 interviews will be online in a couple of days. Thank you to Ann Cooper. Keep up the good work.